Hold on just one moment.
Do you have Charlie's materials down there?
Do you have Charlie's?
I left him up there the last time.
All right, you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Jim Neal, and I represent the petitioner and appellant, Mr. Arsene Hicks. This case will decide not only whether Mr. Hicks timely filed his habeas petition, but also whether Virginia courts have any authority at all to enforce the rights of the Constitution guaranteed by cases like Miranda, Gidgin, and Brady after the direct appeals conclude. The Commonwealth urges this court to have Virginia stand alone and rule that Mr. Hicks' petition is not timely, that Mr. Hicks, in fact, had no opportunity at all to file a habeas petition once he found out about the illegal suppression of evidence that occurred prior to his conviction. The Commonwealth argues that its agent, in this case Detective Robert Glenn Ford, may suppress evidence, and if he's successful in doing so for long enough, it may evade review by any court for any reason because of the statute of limitations in 8.01654. This is not the law. In fact, Virginia stands exactly as the vast majority of other jurisdictions do.
Counsel, let me ask you a question before we get started. I think you're only here on the constitutional issue. You've got two other assignments of error, but tell me why those weren't defaulted under Rule 5:25.
Because, Your Honor, the issues were squarely presented to the circuit court.
How were they presented to him? He never mentioned them at all in his opinion letter.
Mr. Hicks did not cite 801-229D. He did not cite the Haas versus Lee case. But as the court suggested in prior arguments, he squarely presented that issue. He made clear the fact that the Commonwealth had suppressed evidence. He made clear the fact that the Commonwealth was a defendant. He made clear the fact that he didn't know about that suppression. And he made clear the fact that that was actionable. Those are the elements of 8.01229. The issue was squarely presented, Your Honor. The law does not require, and Rule 525 does not require, particularly a pro se petitioner like Mr. Hicks, to encant magic words.
I don't think there's magic words there, but I think the judge has to understand what the argument is. And certainly, Judge Martin, the trial judge, he's a good trial judge, understood clearly that the issue before him was the constitutional issue.
The issue before him was the timeliness of the petition, Your Honor. And it's the functional equivalent of a trial attorney standing up and saying, I object to this testimony because it is a third-party, out-of-court statement offered for the truth of the assertion. That's what Mr. Hicks did. Mr. Hicks need not say hearsay, and Mr. Hicks certainly need not say that violates Virginia Rule of Evidence 6.802 or 2.802.
Okay. I'm not sure I agree with it, but you can move on.
Thank you, Your Honor. Neither the statutory tolling issue nor the issue of equitable tolling under Haas versus Lee were waived. The only issue before the court was the timeliness of the petition, and for three separate reasons, Virginia is exactly like every other jurisdiction in America. Like 47 other states, like the District of Columbia, and like the federal government, it provides mechanisms for petitioners like Mr. Hicks to assert habeas claims when they find out about long-standing illegal suppression of exculpatory evidence. It does so three ways. Number one, the tolling statute at 8.01229D. Number two, this court's doctrine in Haas versus Lee, whether that's properly characterized as a creature of equitable tolling or something else. And number three, the doctrine of equitable estoppel. And I'll take each in turn unless the court wants to direct the discussion to some specific point now. 8.01229 states in very uncertain terms that when the filing of an action is obstructed by a defendant using any direct or indirect means, the period during which that obstruction continues shall not count for any applicable statute of limitations. It's absolutely prescriptive, it's absolutely unequivocal, and the General Assembly has made repeatedly clear that it knows how to do two things when it wants to. When it wants to shield the statute of limitations from the effect of the tolling statute, it does so. It did so in 8.01244, it did so in 8.01243.1. It says, and this is not difficult, notwithstanding the provisions of 8.01229, here is the statute of limitations for this cause of action. The General Assembly did not do that with the habeas statute. The General Assembly has also demonstrated that it knows exactly how to carve, to immunize other statutes of limitations within the text of 8.01 to 29D. In other subsections of that statute, subsection A, I believe, clearly says, except for statutes of limitations, and it itemizes several. 8.01654 is simply not among them. There is absolutely no conflict at all between 8.01654 and 8.01229D. In Mr. Hicks's case, he has 1 year from the date his direct appeal concludes. That was October 9th, 2004. That 1 year runs, and when that 1 year is up, the statute of limitations expires. However, as 8.01229D makes perfectly clear, any time the defendant obstructs during that 1 year does not count. Robert Glenn Ford, the detective now in federal prison, obstructed from the time of Mr. Hicks' initial interview on January 2nd, 2000, until Mr. Hicks received Mr. Roscoe's affidavit in October of 2012. Less than 7 months later, Mr. Hicks filed his petition with the habeas court. It was timely. Even if that statute, that tolling statute, were not, by its own express and unequivocal words, sufficient to render the petition timely, this court's holding in Haas versus Lee would do so. That was after 8.01654A was enacted. It was a relatively new statute. The General Assembly, like many, many other jurisdictions, had said, we want finality with habeas claims. We are going to impose a one-year statute of limitation. And Mr. Haas, who had been convicted in 1994, four years before the statute became effective, filed a habeas petition. He did so about 2 years after the statute was effective. And this court said, we are not going to apply the literal terms of 801-654A, because if we did that, anybody convicted more than 1 year before the statute was enacted would be out of luck. That would be unjust. That would be wrong. As impressive as the interest in finality may be, it must yield, because every petitioner must have some reasonable opportunity to file a habeas petition. And this court, in that case, said your reasonable opportunity is 1 year, 1 year after the enactment of the statute in that case. Mr. Hicks seeks no more than this court has already granted unanimously in Haas versus Lee. That is 1 year after he could have first filed his petition, the opportunity to do so.
Do we have to determine, or may we determine, whether or not the underlying Brady claim is meritorious, particularly under the opinion of the court in Workman?
Your Honor,
I realize you want the filing issue to be decided, but
yes,
if we look at this and we look at all of the allegations on their best day,
yes, sir,
and conclude that it does not meet the materiality requirement of Workman, do we reach the other issues?
You wouldn't have to. I would argue, however, Your Honor, that the materiality determination is one for the habeas court to make. It needs to be made against the entire record, not against a joint appendix that was assembled before the issue of materiality was even raised. There is no 8.01654E finding of fact regarding materiality for this court to review. Mr. Hicks alleged a series of facts. Those were not controverted under Rule 1.4, under Morris versus Smith. Those facts are accepted as true, and that's the premise of the habeas court's ruling.
Suppose on those facts a Brady claim is not made out, those facts alleged.
Then the court's ruling should be, as the Commonwealth urges, limited to the issue of timeliness, with a remand to the habeas court for further proceedings, which would include, presumably, a determination of materiality.
No, I must have failed in my question. Suppose on the...
I doubt that's the case, Mr. Chief.
Oh, no, it happens so often. My colleagues tell me that anyway.
I won't.
On the face of what is presented to the court, if you look at it and you say, on your best day, there is no Brady claim, does the case stop? based on the allegations of Hicks?
If this court were to do so, yes. But this court shouldn't, and indeed can't do so, and here's why. This is the most, let me state it as simply as I can. The question of materiality concerns the exculpatory evidence. The exculpatory evidence is the recorded statement. Right. The Commonwealth doesn't contest the existence of the recorded statement. The Commonwealth doesn't contest its suppression, but neither this court, nor the litigants, nor the habeas court have the recorded statement in front of them. The evidence continues to be suppressed. There's no opportunity to make a materiality determination regarding evidence which has yet to be produced. Looking at the record, however...
That's an interesting dilemma, because we don't know what's in there.
What we do know, Your Honor, from even the joint appendix, right, is that counsel at the trial court level certainly suggested that evidence of this sort would be material. Mr. Reed, the defense attorney, in opening statement, strongly suggested that Mr. Roscoe, the affiant, the provider of the recorded statement, might have been the shooter. And in fact, the Commonwealth conceded as much, the materiality of it in closing argument, when Ms. Bowen stood up and said, boy, it would have been a lot more impressive if the defendant, now the petitioner, had mustered any evidence at all that Roscoe might have been the gunman. But there is no such evidence. I would suggest to the court that it's inequitable to allow the Commonwealth to argue that the evidence would have been material at the trial court, but no one would have
and continue to suppress it.
I'm sorry.
I see, what you're saying is that if something was so clear on its face that Brady doesn't even touch this, you could get rid of it based upon the fact that on its best day, the defendant, petitioner in this case, would never have a Brady claim. But where there's a colorable claim, it would be inequitable to allow the Commonwealth to actually continue to suppress that which you want to prove is material.
The Chief Justice answered his question much better than I could have. That's exactly
right. Every once in a while I get it right.
And if the tolling statute didn't apply, Haas versus Lee would. And if Haas versus Lee didn't, the doctrine of equitable estoppel would. Three separate means, the timeliness of the petition is established. And unless the court has more specific questions at the moment, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
You have 2 minutes and 50 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Alice Armstrong on behalf of the Director. Your Honors, Virginia Code Section 8.01654A2 contains a clear, unambiguous, unequivocal command that a petition for writ of habeas corpus challenging a criminal conviction shall be filed within the specified time. This court held in Hines that the statute contains no exception. The petitioner is asking the court to read an exception into a statute that contains none. We maintain that the trial court in this case properly applied the statute of limitations, properly determined that there is no suspension of the writ infirmity in the statute of limitations, and we ask the court to affirm. I would also note, just and as a starting point, Hines has been the law for over a decade now. The General Assembly has not acted to correct this court's construction of that statute, and so we assume that they have acquiesced in this court's construction of the statute that there is no exception. It is a specific statute. It governs only habeas corpus. The only cross-reference it makes is to another habeas corpus proceeding in capital cases. It's self-contained under Daniels versus Warden. That controls. That really is the end of the inquiry.
Well, I think that the petitioner is arguing that 8.01229D is an exception. Why is it not?
I understand that's his argument. My first response to that is Rule 5:25. He never suggested below that there was any way, manner, method, mechanism, anything else, for the trial court to reach the timeliness question other than his argument regarding the suspension clause and B2. That's what he put before the court. That's what the court ruled on. There was a fairly tart motion to reconsider that was filed in the trial court. At no point did Mr. Hicks suggest to the trial judge that he had failed to address other ways or methods for the court to conclude that the filing was timely. The only thing that was asserted below was the suspension clause. So the principal submission to this court is that it's waived. The other response, Your Honor, is under this court's case law, to make out a claim under 229D, you have to show moral turpitude. There's no moral turpitude in this case, and as much as Mr. Hicks would love for this case to be about Detective Ford, Detective Ford didn't have a Brady obligation to him. The Commonwealth attorney had a Brady obligation. And he has conceded that Brady doesn't turn on the nature or the character of the Commonwealth attorney. Brady turns on the character of the evidence itself. So there's not a moral turpitude. They can't satisfy the moral turpitude requirement to invoke 229D, even if that had been properly before the trial court. Brady, I don't think you can ever show moral turpitude in Brady because there can be a Brady violation from an inadvertent failure to disclose.
Are you talking about under 229D? You're talking about 229D.
Yes.
There's a moral turpitude component to that?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe I cited a case on brief that says that. Court's indulgence? Yes, Your Honor, Newman versus Walker, Your Honor, 270 Virginia. And it says the requisite fraud to invoke tolling under 229D, and this is the quote from the court, must be of that character which involves moral turpitude and must have the effect of debarring or deterring the plaintiff from action. So under this court's precedent.
What year was that case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, it's 270 Virginia, and it was 2005. Newman versus Walker, Your Honor.
Counsel, are you saying that in a certain case, and I'm not saying this is the case at all, that if the police suppressed evidence which caused a fraud upon the court, that could not be challenged by this code section?
I don't.
Say something even beyond Brady, something where actually they suppressed evidence.
Something
other than Brady.
Well, I think under the circumstances, I'm not sure that it would give rise or that it would excuse. I'm not sure that it would excuse the statute of limitations in a habeas case. It might give rise to a separate cause of action.
Like a fresh actual innocence or something.
Well, it might give rise to a 1983 claim, but I'm also thinking that it would separately and independently support a motion to vacate the judgment based on the extrinsic fraud upon the court. I think there possibly would be a separate civil rights cause of action for the wrongful conviction.
But just can't reach it through the statute is your argument.
Right. That's correct, Your Honor. Well, not in habeas corpus you can't reach it through this statute. I mean, there may be circumstances in some other situation where you could invoke that statute, but I don't think you can overcome the habeas corpus statute of limitations under those circumstances. Correct. Again, because the habeas corpus statutes stand alone. They're sui generis, essentially. I mean, habeas corpus is sui generis. It's really different from, because it is an extraordinary writ. It's different from a regular civil action.
Let me ask you, if you can talk about the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus.
Yes, I would be glad to talk about that. This court in Hines said it was unnecessary to reach that because the factual predicate didn't lie, and my argument is the same. In this case, the factual predicate doesn't lie, which addresses the Brady claim, but more specifically to the suspension of the writ, Your Honor. those cases really address a situation not where there's a limitation on the cause of action, if you will. Those cases address a situation where, by legislative creation, the legislature is forcing people out of habeas corpus and to use some alternative proceeding in the nature of habeas corpus. And the quintessential example is the federal post-trial motion under 28 U.S.C. Section 2255, which is the mechanism federal petitioners must use instead of habeas corpus. And other states, my friends on the other side cited a case from Washington, and it was a similar situation. They had effectively eliminated habeas corpus and supplanted it with a different procedural mechanism to assert habeas corpus type claims. The other case I cited on brief to the court is the, I can't pronounce the name, so forgive me, I'm going to mangle it, Bomindi, the Guantanamo Bay detainee case. And that also addressed some other separation of powers issues because that was pretrial detention by the executive, but that's one of the few cases where the court has actually said this does violate the suspension clause because we're funneling people out of habeas corpus, we're making them invoke some other proceeding, and you know what, it's really not effective for addressing the claim. No court has ever said a statute of limitations violates the suspension clause. At least I'm not aware of one, and my friends have not cited a case to you. They say that that's immaterial, but I would suggest to this court that what they're asking this court to do is to blaze a brand new trail.
Their argument is that no court has addressed it because all of the other states have some means to accept the statute of limitations. There is some other means of getting around the statute of limitations. Why is that not the answer as to why no one else?
Well, again, I would say because the General Assembly, in enacting a statute of limitations, has not said you have to use some other mechanism. They've said, if you want to use this mechanism and you're welcome to do it, you have to do it within this amount of time.
Is it possible, the question that Justice Lemons asked of opposing counsel, is it possible for this case to be decided on the materiality of the evidence? First question, because it's before us on a statute of limitations assignment of error. Second question, the statement, if recorded, if made, has never been produced. So can this court decide the issue on materiality?
I think to the extent this court wants to follow the precedent that it laid down in Hines, which was basically leaving the door open to the discussion that we're having today. There may be a case somewhere, sometime, someday, in which the suspension clause might possibly be implicated because of the facts of the particular case. I think the court can reach the Brady question insofar as, just as the court did in Hines, saying, well, there might be a case, but this case isn't it. And just as in Hines, because the factual predicate was not there, that wasn't the case to address it. The submission here is, this isn't the case to address it either, because he cannot show materiality. Here's why. And can I take one moment to take a step back? I have not conceded anything in this case. I did not address the merits of the Brady claim below, but I generally denied the allegations. It's at page 1727 of the appendix. Because that's what you do in a plea and bar. You assert the plea and bar. And you let the court resolve the procedural question before you address the merits of the claim. But I think you can address, I think it is possible for the court to reach the question of materiality given the entire record that's before the court, because that's a legal question. You don't have to make a factual determination to address that. I haven't addressed the other two aspects of the Brady claim because that would require fact-finding. So under Perry and Banks, the court is not in a position to do that. But I think the court is in the position to address the question of materiality. And I will say to the court candidly, as I have shared with my friend candidly, I don't know if there is a recorded statement or not. I did not investigate that. I have no idea if that's factually, if the assertion is factually correct. The trial court certainly did not make a finding that there was a Brady violation. The trial court didn't make any factual findings. The trial court said, legally, you're too late. But what I would say to this court is, given the posture of the case, we take the allegations as true. And the allegation is that Larry Roscoe told the police that the items identified as those involved in the murder at the trial were his items. Well, no one really contested that. It was very clear to the jury that the gun was Larry Roscoe's gun. Everyone knew it was Larry Roscoe's gun. Everyone. The jury was told it was Larry Roscoe's gun. But the defendant pleaded guilty.
Well, let's back up. Mr. Roscoe also said that they couldn't have been out of my possession, which the other side infers to mean I did it. I'm just not going
to
say it.
And I'm going to address that right now.
Okay.
Mr. Hicks pleaded guilty to the carjacking and the robbery and the use of the firearms for offenses that occurred mere hours before this murder that involved the exact same firearm. There was never a suggestion that there was more than one firearm. There's one. It's Larry Roscoe's gun. Apparently it was the house gun because they were all using it in a series of other robberies. But the suggestion is that Larry Roscoe was the shooter, but there are two problems with that. One, under the facts of this case, given his guilty plea and using the lexicon that's in the record here, it's no way possible that Larry Roscoe had exclusive control and possession of that firearm that night. And the second problem for Mr. Hicks with his suggestion that Larry Roscoe is really the shooter is that he told the jury under oath that Larry Roscoe was not the shooter.
It was Mo, right?
It was Mo. We've heard from Larry now. Maybe not the shooter is Curly. I don't know. But he cannot overcome his sworn testimony to the jury. It's at page, I believe, 1434 of the appendix. Excuse me, 1334 of the appendix. Larry Roscoe was not the shooter.
Mr. Armstrong, before you ran out of time, you had cited the Newman case.
Yes, sir.
And your work is entirely on the criminal side of the world. Newman is a civil case.
Yes.
And there is, although some lawyers would probably like this, there is no Brady equivalent in the civil litigation world. You discovery is something that is initiated by parties and responded to, etc. It seems to me that the distinction between Newman and this case is that Newman says that fraud is what is the thing that you do to trigger the tolling, because there's no independent obligation to produce anything. So in the discovery process, you make a request. If you fraudulently answer the request, that is the kind of moral turpitude that this case talks about that triggers the tolling under 8.01229. Well, Brady is the functional equivalent on the criminal side, and that's why I don't think Newman applies. I thought I'd give you the opportunity to respond.
Well, of course, Your Honor, the principal submission is that it's waived because it was not properly raised.
Well, I do know that, and you certainly have preserved that. But if it gets to the merits, I'm suggesting to you that in a criminal context, Brady is the issue, not the moral turpitude of fraud.
Okay. Well, I would also, if I may, observe that Larry Roscoe gave this purported accepting everything is true because I don't know. Accepting everything as true, Larry Roscoe gave this affidavit in 2006. I don't think the time that Farrell Richardson sat on this affidavit for 6 years is chargeable to the Commonwealth.
All right.
And so even assuming he's entitled to some kind of belated commencement, it had certainly run by the time he filed this petition.
All right. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. The issue is not waived. Mr. Hicks gave notice of the substance of his argument in the habeas court. That's all that Overton requires. Even if that weren't true, the ends of justice would require that this court consider the issue preserved for a 16-year-old pro se informal pauperous defendant.
Well, if you're talking about ends of justice, do we then look at the materiality of this alleged violation?
On the materiality, Your Honor. The affidavit refers not only to a firearm, gun, mask, shoes, and jacket. Those four items collectively have relevance to one and only one crime. That's the open house diner shooting. The Commonwealth tried to make the shoes an issue with the robbery of Mr. Migliaccio, the one to which Mr. Hicks pled guilty. There was no information, no testimony about the shoes. The witness was unable to describe the shoes. The shoes are only relevant because the gunman, whether that was Moe or Larry or Curly, stood up on the counter of the diner and left an imprint. This is material evidence. This goes to the open house diner. It has no bearing at all on any other crime. As to the suspension clause, the Commonwealth is asking this court to run headlong into a suspension clause problem. Judge Sotomayor has said twice, once in the Rodriguez case as a district court judge, and once in Lucidor as a Second Circuit judge, a statute of limitations with no exceptions is an absolute bar to habeas. You're closing the gate to all the constitutional guarantees that are on the other side of the fence. Mr. Hicks never, not for one day, would have been able to timely file this claim. And let me illustrate the problem most clearly, if I may. If the Supreme Court of the United States tomorrow were to say that 16-year-olds may not be tried as adults for capital murder, not an utterly inconceivable newly recognized constitutional right, Mr. Hicks would have one and only one avenue to challenge his conviction, and that's habeas. And yet when he got to the gate, it would be locked, because the Commonwealth, if it were able to convince this court of its position, would have said, I'm sorry, more than a year has elapsed since the conclusion of your direct appeal. Gidgeon, Miranda, Brady, every single substantive guarantee in the Constitution would be unreachable to any defendant 1 year after his direct appeal concludes. That's not the law. That's a violation of the suspension clause, and that's why the Commonwealth's position is wrong. My time has elapsed. Unless the court has further questions, I'd ask you to reverse and remand.
Thank you. Call the next case.
Thank you.